You're listening to the Jason Gregor Show podcast, brought to you by Lakewood Chev. All Silverados and Truck Nation overlay, 10 to 15 specials with cash rebates or payments. All trucks are showing max factory rebates. Learn more at LakewoodChev.com. Lots to discuss. We got some hockey, we got some football, some basketball, and more. So we get to Matt Sakaris joining us from TSN in Vancouver. Matty, welcome back to the show, my man. What's your thoughts as a guy who I know has followed the league for a long, long time, and the CFL is fining one of their best players for, like, the most innocuous tweet ever? Like, when you're trying, like, the fans love the fact that their players comment on games on social media, and now the CFL say, oh, God, whatever you do, don't do that, because we don't want any more. The last thing we want is more young people following our players. Like, it's stupid.
I agree with you on that, of course. Boy, it seems like Twitter is just, in the eyes of sports leagues and teams, like this evil, demonic form of communication when it can be very, very effective, quite frankly. Look, I agree with you from the generational and demographic standpoint, Jason, that is the way that young people on social media communicate, and we should do our utmost to communicate to them the way they want to be communicated to in order to help grow the future fan base of the Canadian Football League. The other thing I'll say about that is you've covered the league as well. Part of the CFL genius, part of the reason that it has been able to survive so many bad owners, so many bad years, when you think back to the 90s, and I guess it wasn't as pronounced in Edmonton, but, you know, as someone who lived back east, you know, basket case franchises left, right, and center, and frankly, one here in Vancouver at 1.2, was the connectivity between fans and players. You know, I grew up in Ottawa, Calgary, Montreal. I met new players from all those teams.
Yeah.
In those cities. And so this is just another way for CFL players and individuals to communicate with the fan bases. And it's a reach out and touch league. It's, you know, a get to know the players and coaches league. And I think it would behoove the league and its teams to look at Twitter as a vehicle to achieve those aims.
Oh, and I just, every time you think they'll take a step forward, I lose faith in the CFL, because I'm just not sure they're ever going to get it. Just when I think,
I'll disagree here, Jason. I have high hopes for Randy Ambrosi. You don't?
Well, only because you could have the best commissioner in the CFL. If the owners who still run the league don't want to let a commissioner make decisions, it's not going to be.
Yes. Yes. And quite frankly, Jason, your franchise there in Edmonton has been the most guilty of being the fiefdom looking out for our own backyard, not thinking league around the Board of Governors table. Ask Jameson, he can tell you. Anyways, let me say this. I have high hopes for Randy Ambrosi on this score. He is a terrific communicator. Had him on the program today. He comes off as a facile, very easy guy to talk to. He's open and honest, from best I can tell so far. And I think when you have a skilled communicator at the head of the Board of Governors table, despite the worry, which is always going to be there with the CFL Board of Governors, I think he has got the skill set to be able to get them together and get them on the same page a little better.
So to get him on the page and get him going in the right direction, does he have to be more forceful or more tactful?
Yeah, I think it's tactful, Jason.
Okay.
I really do, because quite frankly, you know, as someone who has covered and known David Braley for a long time, no one's going to tell David Braley what to do. He's a rich guy who's used to hearing yes, and he's going to hear yes. And so it's going to be how you tiptoe around the Braleys of the world, as well as, you know, the way you handle the different changing guys at the table from the community-owned franchises. And how you handle guys who may be a little down on their luck, like the Lions right now and the Argos right now, who aren't exactly driving great attendance numbers, and the way you handle a team like Ottawa that's feeling pretty good about itself with sold-out houses, and one of the success stories of the league. But, yeah, it's a great distinction to make, because I think we have passed the day of the, you know, hammer time CFL commissioner, the judge who's going to drop gavel. You know, Mike Lisko was that guy, and he didn't last very, very long. But I have a feeling that Ambrosi is a skillful enough communicator that he's going to be able to tiptoe around some of the issues, get guys on board, build constituencies. And here's the other thing. Jeffrey Orange came off as a guy who was straight out of business school. I mean, he said every conversation I had with him, it sounded like he was a CEO reporting to shareholders, you know, on a quarterly basis. He was just the language he used in a lot of cases was inaccessible. And of course, he's put his he stuck his foot in his mouth on CTE at the Grey Cup last year. Jason, you were there. I have much higher hopes for Ambrosi.
From the day he stepped in as commissioner, Matt, remember when like everything was a colossal fail on his first press conference? They're trying to unveil a new logo and a website, and it wasn't even working. Yeah, it was a gong show from day one.
No, they got him wrong. But guys, let's understand. The board got him wrong. And the board has gotten a lot of commissioners wrong. And so that board has to be better, too. Like, I would hope that the Jeffrey Orange experiment had every single one of those guys, you know, the community-owned representatives, as well as the guys who have real money, real flesh in the game, like Braley and Young and Wettenhall, to look themselves in the mirror and say, hey, we're supposed to be successful business guys. How come we keep screwing up our most important hire? Yeah,
well, and that's the key. If they can look in the mirror and be like, hey, what can our league do better? Well, it starts with them maybe saying, we don't really know what to do, so let's hire someone and let him do it and see where it goes. Now,
Or let's empower him.
Yeah, you know, sure.
Like other leagues have empowered their commissioners.
Now, you mentioned the Lions are having a tough time. The Vancouver Canucks, I read online an article like 16 to 20% down in season ticket. You know, this is a team that obviously has had a few down years, but nothing compared to what Edmonton experienced for a decade. How much concern is there from the ownership? What are they going to do? Do you see this being any sort of, you know, step in the right direction, turnaround season for the Canucks?
I think the concern was more pronounced a year ago than it is now. I think they are somewhat resigned to their lot in life here, that it is going to be difficult over the next few years, both on the ice and at the box office. My sense is the people in the building believe the worst is behind them. I'm not necessarily sure that that's the case. We're talking on ice performance there. And if in fact that report is true that they're down 16-20%, that would be 2 years in a row, Jason, where they are down significantly.
Yeah.
So, now here's the thing. The Aquilini family that owns this team are billionaires. They got in at absolutely the right time and had a long, decade-long sellout streak. So I shed no tears for them. There will be, you know, there will be bread and butter on their table at the end of the day. And they are committed to spending to the cap. And the Canucks actually went out free agency and spent more money, got a little more active in free agency than even Trevor Linden said they would at the trade deadline. One, because they lost a couple of defensemen. One, to the KHL, one to Vegas, and two, because the cap went up and they had some financial flexibility that they didn't necessarily envision, and so they went out and spent the money. But, yeah, do I think this will be the turnaround season? I'm not sure if this will be rock bottom or the first step up from rock bottom, but the fact is they are going to have some young players in the lineup. And so effectively that's where the intrigue of this season is going to come from. How did these young players progress?
Well, you know what? I look at the lineup, I look at the changes, and I love the Sedins as people. I played with them when they were young, and I just think they're great. But I mean, their time has probably, you know, come, and they've had a great run, but it's probably come. But I'm looking through the rest of the lineup, and I'm looking at a group, I'm guessing the coaching and the general managers, that are hoping for the absolute best from everybody to make this happen. Like, can Louis Erickson bounce back? Can Sam Gagner have another good year? Can Brock Boeser look as good as he did in the short term he was there? Like, all these things. Can Tanev really get it done? Delzato, can he be Delzato, not Delzaster? Like, there's a lot of question marks in my – and if I'm a fan, I'm like, whoa, we have to have everything go perfect for us to maybe just make the playoffs.
Doubt. Yeah, no doubt. So many things would have to fall in place for this to be a playoff. Heck, you didn't even mention goaltending. I mean, they don't necessarily have the most dependable goaltending. I mean, we'll see. Jacob Markstrom took some nice steps, and then he got hurt and missed a good portion of time at the end of last year and required surgery. And Anders Nielsen got a pretty fair ticket in free agency, despite the fact that he's, you know, his lifetime numbers aren't necessarily earth-shattering. And Jason, I'm glad to hear you talk about the Sedins the way you did, because, you know, I've long been wanting to ask you, did you not get an audition to be the triplet, to play on the other wing with Henrik and Daniel way back when, sir, huh?
Well, I think the problem was that they, you know, you can't put two sixes and a ten on the same line. You know? And, but, you know, we did. I remember we had training camp there. I don't know if you remember this. We flew all the way there. We had training camp there, and we played some Swedish teams and came home, played a bunch of teams on the way. But those two guys, I mean, they were so humble. Good. You know, they were a little chubby when they were younger, but most, you know, at that time, a lot of young players were. And, but, you know, even now, like, I was there. I saw him at the game in Vancouver, the last game of the year almost, against Vancouver and Edmonton. And they were going on the ice, and they went another way, on their way to the ice to say hi to me again.
Yeah.
But that's how they are. Incredible guys.
They are extraordinary people. They get less hype about this than PK Subban does in Montreal, but they have effectively built the hospital here in Vancouver with their community work and with some very, very generous donations. You mentioned the fact that they were chubby as rookies. Jason, they don't even like to be shown pictures of themselves as rookies and second-year players because they're embarrassed at the way they look, because, you know, now they've become these physical fitness marvels and the two best-conditioned guys on the team. And, you know, the sad part for me, and, like, speed was never a part of their game. The NHL's gotten so fast, they're just getting outpaced. And last year it became painfully obvious that when they do not have the puck, they're absolute liabilities on the ice. There is no puck recovery that gets done, one, because of lack of foot speed, you know, two, because they're not exactly, you know, the Selke trophy guys, never were, but they were confident defensively. Now it's very difficult to watch them when they don't have the puck. So I suspect that this will be the swan song. Sayonara, they'll take their bows and then head off into retirement. And the Canucks will have $14 million to spend next year in free agency.
Matt Skaris joins us from TSN in Vancouver. Matt, I've heard Tanev's name a lot in trade talk. What do you make of that? Why would they trade him?
Why? Because he is an asset that is not getting any better and may not be the contributor he is now when they get to a window where they're playoff competitive again. He's on a pretty good contract. He had a limited no trade clause kick in on July 1st, so I think that's why you heard a little bit about his name in trade rumors. It has very much died off, principally because they lost two defensemen, one in free agency, one in the KHL, and so they felt like that it might be difficult to lose yet another defenseman, this one of their own volition. And the other thing is, you know, he is a wonderful defensive hockey player. He is very smart positionally, has a good stick, makes a good first pass and all of that, but he doesn't do anything for you offensively. And so, you know, I felt for a team that has been towards the bottom, if not at the bottom of the league in scoring goals over the last couple of years, I think they have they explored or at least listened to Chris Tanev's offers because he doesn't bring a lot offensively. But, you know, here's the thing. Pretty early on in the process after the season, it became apparent to them, and, you know, I had somebody mention this to me with the Canucks, that for once in, you know, maybe all our lifetimes, the blue moon, it became a buyer's market on defense for the NHL. With the Vegas expansion draft and Vegas getting all these defensemen and being able to peddle them and teams looking to move defensemen so that they didn't have to protect them in the expansion draft. So, you know, I don't necessarily feel like they felt the market conditions were right to reap maximum value for Tanev back in a trade.
Randy, one final one for you. Looking ahead to the BC Lions, and, you know, you got Jennings at quarterback. I really like that team. You mentioned they're slipping a little bit in fans, where I know that Wally Bono at the top understands the importance of it. They've tried to do everything to make their team, I think, more fan friendly. Any reason why there's been a dip in attendance?
It's a great question, Jason, because quite frankly, they were doing better in attendance several years ago when they weren't nearly as entertaining or as good. So it is somewhat of a mystery to me. They have put in special ticket pricing for kids through the summer to try and get families out, because ticket pricing, I do believe, is one of the issues that they're facing. But, you know, it is odd. You know, the Canucks, the Lions have both taken attendance hits. Even the Whitecaps, to a lesser degree, or MLS team, aren't the guaranteed book it sellout that they once were. There's something happening with the sports ticket consumer here in Vancouver and the Lower Mainland, and the Lions are the most acute example of that, which is disappointing because the quarterback is worth the price of admission, and with the receiving group they've got, Manny Arsenault, Brian Burnham, who will make every catch across the middle, even if he's getting walloped, and eventually when Chris Williams, ex of the Ottawa Redblacks and Hamilton Tiger Cats, gets on the field, I mean, they could be electrifying on offense. Running back returner Chris Rainey, who's a U.S. national level sprinter in his heyday. I mean, they could be so much fun to watch on offense. And this market, for whatever reasons, and I think ticket price is probably at the top of that list, hasn't responded.
Well, Matt, I'll say this. I think getting out of the West in the playoffs between BC, Edmonton, and Calgary is going to be a battle. It's probably some of the best games we've seen in a while in the playoffs. Always great to catch up with you, man. We'll talk to you again soon.
All right, Jason Squared. Thanks for the time, guys. You good.
That's Akaris from TSN.